This is episode 3 of Talking With, Brian Lamb's conversation with historian Richard Norton Smith. It starts after this.
What were your grades?
They were fine. They were
straight A's.
They got me at Harvard.
But were they straight A's?
No, I don't think they were straight A's. I think I was, for example, science was never, and I regret it to this day. I mean, I think that's a real deficiency. I was, for the most part, and I never took algebra. I don't know why anyone would ever, you know. I mean, I can't pretend that I knew when I was 8 or 9 what I was going to do, but I certainly knew what I was interested in.
Do you remember when a teacher returned an essay that you had to write and said, A plus, this is really good?
There were a few of those. The one that stands actually, I remember at Harvard, I did an independent study course with Doris Kearns Goodwin.
She was the professor?
She was a professor teaching a presidential history course that I was enrolled in. But then I was able, in those days at least, Harvard was notoriously lax, perhaps, in allowing one to explore areas of particular interest and independent study. And she was good enough to agree to this. And I remember I wrote 2 papers, large papers, on LBJ. And she said, she was very kind in her grading, and she said, this is clearly your métier.
Had she written her book on LBJ?
I think she had, or maybe was in the process.
What year were you in Harvard?
Graduated in 75, so I went in the fall of 71, same year as Derek Buck, the new president who succeeded Nathan Pusey following the disturbances of the late 60s.
But if you go back to the high school years, and did you move around up there in Massachusetts?
No, and I think that contributes. We were in one place, and that gave me an opportunity to really kind of dig below the surface, examining the history of the town in which I grew up.
But what was your high school like, and do you have any memories of the impact that might have had on you? Did anybody care, by the way, that you were this interested in history?
No, I was, to be perfectly honest with you, I think I was probably seen as a sort of strange duck.
Really?
Unconventional.
Why? I mean, what was unconventional? Did you do anything else in high school besides this kind of stuff?
Yeah, I remember doing plays.
Very
interested in the theater.
Acting?
Yes, and musicals especially, which was obviously a preview of coming attractions. No, it was just, it's an awful thing to say. This is several years ago, I was invited back to a reunion, and I'm ashamed to say I didn't go. And I shouldn't say, but because I thought, you know, I didn't know what to say to those people when I was in the same room with them. What would I possibly talk about now? And that's terribly fair, and it sounds terribly snobbish. It was no element of snobbery. It was just I remember my mother once saying, I must have been 10 or 11, saying to a friend, I was standing there, he lives in a world of his own. And I think that's probably, I think there are probably a lot of kids who live in a world of their own. What saved me, because lots of kids get chewed up in high school. They get chewed up, they get bullied, they get whatever. But the system doesn't make room for individuality, eccentricity, whatever you want to label it. And I was lucky. I had a savior in the librarian school. Her name was Laura Conway, and she was originally from New Jersey, and she had been school librarian for some time. And she was wonderful. She had this, I think she was a quiet rebel against the machine of high school. And she valued above all else creativity. That was her, you know, she was a sort of Auntie Mame-like figure in some ways. And creativity was her mantra. And she thought I was creative. And, you know, we pulled off stunts, and not all of which I look back on with pride, but I always knew that I had a refuge. And literally, I could go to the library, and there was a back room in the library where I, you know, I remember reading. And I'll never forget what it was. I feel badly about it now. She had an assistant, a very nice lady, who one day I think I just probably annoyed the hell out of. I mean, I'm sure I could be obnoxious. And she, who was somewhat more conventional, I think just kind of, I don't know, said something. And I'll never forget, Mrs. Connolly waylaid her, pulled her aside. Don't you ever, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And now I look back and I'm somewhat embarrassed by it. But I realize how incredibly lucky and what a you know, chance relationship that was. And we stayed, I'll tell you how close we were. I graduated in 1971. She died in May of 1988. And I read over the phone to her every word that I wrote in every book that I wrote as long as she lived. And that was a lot of words. And
why did you do that?
First of all, I had great respect for her judgment. Secondly, I was hopefully cognizant enough to know that I would probably hear praise. I was discovering the art, and I knew she was very discerning. She was very discriminating. She had excellent taste, and I came to understand that she herself was someone who felt apart from her surroundings. She was very successful professionally, and she had wonderful children, but they were grown up, and I don't think her work fulfilled her. She, I think, as she got older, and I sense this with older people, and now that I'm at the age, I understand it better. She lived a bit vicariously through my experiences. So, for example, the day that I graduated from Harvard, anyone who's been to a Harvard commencement knows how impossible it is to get tickets. She was there. I made sure that she was there. She had encouraged me to apply to Harvard at a time when that was the most improbable. A, we had no money. No one could imagine paying for it. But B, you know, it was presumptuous to think that, you know, that my grades were such. But she, you know, strongly urged me to do it. And I did it, I think, largely on her recommendation. And it worked out. So she probably is the that teacher, that figure who, first of all, was an inspiration, but equally important was a source of protection.
What was your relationship with your brothers and sisters? And how many of them are still alive?
Yeah, I have three sisters who are still living. I had an older brother who, sadly, in the summer of 1980, put a shotgun in his mouth and ended his life.
What were the circumstances?
It's a tangle. You can never be sure. He had had, you know, he'd quit school in the 10th grade, which was a tragedy because he was, very bright and had some drug problems. Went into the Army, where apparently he did very well. initially, but I guess the drug problems recurred. He had three children. His first daughter, who now is in her 40s, we became close. Frankly, much closer than I'd ever been to Frank. The irony is, and I don't mean to sound calculated, when he died, by that time I had already delivered eulogies for my grandmother and grandfather, who I mentioned earlier, and really whom I grew up around. But anyway, when Frank died, it was, of course, a totally different situation. He wasn't elderly, and there was this overwhelming sense of futility and blame. I mean, I can only imagine. You know, you hear that there's nothing worse for a parent than to lose a child. And I'm sure that's true. But if it's, you know, at the child's own hand, it's hard to imagine, however unjustified it may be, the level of guilt that one might feel. And, you know, I saw my parents, you know, went to pieces. I understand it. But, I mean...
Did they ever recover from it?
I'm not sure you ever fully recover. I never forget my mother, who's gone now, so I could tell the story. On the Sunday after the funeral, was missing. She wasn't at home. Well, it turned out she was at the cemetery, sprawled on the grave site, in effect, communicating with her dead child. I mean, there's a kind of madness that grief can produce. And fortunately, she had the character and the obligations, you know, to go on. And but it was you know, you're never comfortable seeing your parents vulnerable, and they were probably never more vulnerable than that time. So my function was, actually, I delivered the eulogy, which on the face of it maybe didn't make sense, except I want to be careful how I say this. I think I had an understanding of what needed to be said to try in some small way to make sense out of what was a senseless act. And I mean, the whole business, you know, about eulogizing people is, first of all, to give some comfort to the living. And that's, you know, as you know, I've had occasion to deliver more than my share. That's the one, actually, where I think I succeeded in that function.
What about the three sisters? What were those relationships like?
Well, they were fine. I have an older sister, like me, like a redhead, like me, has an acerbic tongue, and a very verbal, sometimes slashing wit. I mean, dinner in the Smith household was almost a sitcom-like experience, where the wit, sometimes vicious, Dorothy Parker-esque vicious, was directed usually at my father, who was a good sport, you know. And now, all these years later, the one real regret I have is that I wasn't more appreciative of my father and what he did. I mean, he made it possible for me to go to Harvard.
You know, they
sold some land that they owned to, you know, I took out some substantial student loans, which took me several years to pay off. So, and in those days, Harvard, I won't say it was affordable, but it was a lot more affordable than it is now. So, but they, you know, they were extraordinarily generous. And another thing they did, I started collecting presidential autographs. I started collecting politicians' autographs. early. And they got caught up in it. And again, they didn't have much money, and yet they gave me a Lincoln autograph, you know.
What did it cost them?
Well, I know what it costs now. I don't know what it cost then. They've gone through the roof. But, you know, you couldn't touch it for less than $15,000 today. I think maybe $3,000, $4,000. But, I mean, $3,000, $4,000 was an awful lot of money to them. And it's funny. I think probably most of us, generalizations are dangerous. And I certainly don't purport to speak for anyone but myself. But I suspect most of us, if we were given truth serum, would confess to harboring some feelings of regret, if not guilt, that we didn't appreciate our parents at a time when they were defining their lives.
How much education did they have?
High school. My mother was valedictorian of her high school class, but again, for economic reasons, partly, and also because, you know, women weren't expected to go to college in those days. So she was a, as I said, she was a nurse. She, and I think it started very early, when she was 8 or 9 years old, her grandfather, my great-grandfather, was a farmer, and he was very, very devoted to her. And he was dying a horrible death, cancer of the jaw. And she was the only one he would let in her sick room, in his sick room. And she nursed him, and really still a child. But I think that's where her interest in nursing took hold. And it's interesting because my parents, again, these things only come to you later on. You realize she never talked about her work, although it must have been horrible parts. I mean, I remember once she came home, and it was very clear. It had been a really rough night. She worked nights. And there was an auto accident involving young people. And I guess it had just been terrible, beyond words. And she's, you know, said a little bit about it. But obviously didn't want to share the horrors. She did tell a story, which I never forgot. Talk about macabre. As a very young nurse, she did a stint at what was then the Danvers State Hospital for the criminally insane, it was an insane asylum, to use an old and discredited term, that housed criminals. And she did tell a story about this middle-aged to late middle-aged woman, seemingly normal, dangerous word, no such thing, but certainly not someone who called attention to herself as a dangerous figure anyway. And, you know, this went on for some time. And finally, my mother was curious, and she asked someone, you know, what's her story? Well, it turned out her husband went to work one day, and forgive me, for reasons unexplained then or later, she put their baby in the oven. And I guess the story stuck with me because, first of all, because of its horror, but secondly, because it does illustrate pretty dramatically that surface appearances are just that, surface appearances. And that there is something very, very unknowable about lots of people, including people who don't wind up in asylums.
Did the baby die?
The baby died.
Richard Norton Smith is an American historian and author. You can listen to more interviews with him by searching his name in the video library at cspan.org.